Hello, everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. Today is Monday, May 21st, and I'm your host, Kara Santa Maria. And my guest this week, honestly, kind of needs no introduction. You know, they say that, like, this person needs no introduction, but really, does Carrie Byron need an introduction? Oh my gosh, I'm so excited to have had the opportunity to chat with her. But before we dive into that, I want to thank those of you who made Talk Nerdy possible this week. Remember, the show is and will always be 100% free to download. And the way that I can support the work that I do, along with the hiring of additional people to make the show the best it can be, I rely both on ad sales in the show and on support from you, my incredible patrons. So if you want to pledge your support and make it kind of, I don't know, make the model work, you know what I mean? Make it okay that there are plenty of people out there who are not in a position to support the show, which is fine. That's the whole point. I don't want anybody to have to access this work behind a paywall. I have such a hard time with that. So it's the support from a handful of people like you who are really able to do it that makes it possible that everybody is capable of listening. So I just want to thank those of you who are my top patrons this week. If you want to pledge your support, you just go to patreon.com/talknerdy, and they introduce at the highest level, Rob Schreck. Thank you so very much. At the next level, Phil T-Bear. And at the level after that, the zombie drummer, love your name, David J.E. Smith, Jeffrey Perez, Charles Payet, Jonathan Wright, The Honorable Husband, Jafe Gabriel Felipe Hermio Gonzalez, Brian Holden, and Jeffrey Sewell. And of course, at the $5 tier and lower, there are literally hundreds of you. And I want to thank all of you from the bottom of my heart. Let's pick a few at random because that's so very fun. I want to thank Kate Ertman. I want to thank Ashish Ponce, or maybe Panza, not sure. I want to thank Doug Forsyth. How about Ashley Scroggins? And I also want to thank Greg Johnson. Thank you guys so, so very much. All right, guys, I think it's time. I'm really excited about this. You, of course, know her as a host on Mythbusters. She was on that show for a very long time and made such a lasting impact in the lives of so many people who both loved to learn from the show, but were also inspired to, I don't know, pursue positions in STEAM fields because they saw her there. She has continued to work on several shows since ending her run on Mythbusters. And now she has a brand new book. It's called Crash Test Girl, an unlikely experiment in using the scientific method to answer life's toughest questions. So without any further ado, here she is, Carrie Byron. Carrie, thank you so much for joining me today.
I'm excited to be here.
I am so excited that you wrote this great book because I've been following your work for so long. And I know, like, basically every single person who listens to my podcast has as well. And now they get to dive deep into the life, the love, the all the things that you learned along the way working on Mythbusters and, of course, beyond. Because we're not just talking about the show here. We're talking about your life and we're talking about some of the things that probably you learned from doing the show.
Yeah, I mean, it's a memoir when it comes down to it. It's structured using the scientific method, you know, as my critical thinking tool of analyzing my life. But when it comes down to it, it's a bunch of stories starting from when I was young all the way through my careers.
Oh, I love it. So I, you know, am a self kind of described science communicator. It's what I do for a living. It's what a lot of my friends do and a lot of kind of my peer circles do. I started as a scientist and then ultimately realized I didn't like being in the lab and I wanted to sort of expand the conversation. You are, I think, one of the preeminent science communicators sort of our day, but you're not, you didn't start as a scientist. You were never trained as a scientist, were you?
No, I'm an artist, actually, but I feel like it's something that's parallel to science because you're really just fostering your curiosity and asking a bunch of questions, and one manifests physically and one manifests maybe through chemistry or, you know, an experiment.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, a lot of times people want to really bifurcate these two interests, science and art, and say that they're equal and opposite and say that only certain types of people are good at one versus the other. And we're quote unquote left-brained and right-brained. But we know that that's all total pseudoscience. None of that's true. And really, you need to be somewhat analytic to be an artist, and you need to be somewhat creative to be a good scientist.
I mean, it's really about the way you think about things. I mean, I honestly don't think that we'd be sitting here on our computers on the internet if Ada Lovelace hadn't been half math and half poetry. You know, her dad was Lord Byron and her mom drilled math into her head, and somehow she came out with numbers correlating to pictures, and now we have computer science. I mean, I feel like art and science are holding hands in life.
Oh, absolutely. What a perfect example of that as well. So you were working as an artist, and then how did you end up on MythBusters? Like, I want to back it up a little bit. Did you go to college after high school? Did you, you know, study anything specific? Did you have a career before you had this big switch?
I had jobs. I didn't have a career. Okay. I was an artist, you know, my whole life, I feel like I've been an artist, and I'm a sculptor. I think in 3D, I've just always been that way. And so, you know, I had a bunch of regular jobs, but I wanted to be a sculptor, and I was trying to figure out how to apply that to something that might pay me more than being a starving artist. And since I live in the Bay Area, I'm surrounded by all these amazing special effects shops, like, you know, Lucasfilm and stuff is all right here. So I found Jamie Heineman's studio, which they did toy prototyping and special effects and props. And I went in there just desperate to be a part of it. And it just, you know, turns out that Jamie is willing to hire me if I would work for free. So I quit all my day job. Well, I quit my day jobs. I kept my night job because I was working for free. So I would work in Jamie's shop all day, and then I would go work at night to support myself. And it just turned out that my first day as an intern was also the first day MythBusters started filming. So I just helped behind the scenes a whole bunch. And then by episode 3, they decided they needed to bring in backup builders just to be in the background. And I think it was like within the next season, they realized it would go a lot faster if they made us backup builders talk. So they pushed us in front of the camera and made us hosts. You know, none of us had planned on that, but we all just kind of ran with it.
Wow, I don't think I realized that you were legit there working. It wasn't like an audition situation. You didn't have any television aspirations. You actually kind of passively ended up with this role in front of the camera.
I think it's pretty obvious if you actually watch some of our early episodes. All of us are so, like, me and Scotty and Tori, we are so uncomfortable. I remember specifically we did one about beating the radar where we were covering a car in foil and all this. And every time the camera's looking at us, we look like there's a gun to our head. We're just like, the car was really cool. You know, it's funny to watch it now with hindsight, because TV was a little less polished back in those days. It was sort of Wild West. You know, we were developing a show. It wasn't like we came out the gate with all this kind of shiny expectation in production. I mean, we were all bumbling through it. Discovery went from nature documentaries to trying to do MythBusters. So, you know, I think it was really just learning as we went, just like the show itself.
Absolutely. And it really influenced like an entire wave of television production. And of course, it's so cool to see how, you know, really anybody, if they stick with it, if they learn, basically it's about on the job training. Like, you're there every day, you figure out how to do it. And eventually those fears kind of melted away, right? And you became like, it was second nature to you.
So, I mean, this is why I wrote the book, is that my whole life journey has been as a shy girl trying to learn to be brave. And every time I take one giant leap off a cliff headfirst into a pool of scary, I come out a little bit stronger, and the next thing doesn't seem as scary. So I spend most of my life jumping into situations that are like way over my head and faking my way till I figure it out. That's how I got onto MythBusters. That's how I handle most things. I kind of fake it till I make it. And I feel like it's a good lesson to learn, and one that I've been trying to teach my daughter, is like, bravery is not what superheroes have. I mean, they've got special powers. Bravery is being scared out of your mind and doing it anyway. So that's why I wrote the book, is because A, writing a book seemed terrifying and scary to me. And I had to, I had to live the life I'm trying to teach my daughter to live. And secondly, I feel like I personally love reading memoirs and stuff about people who are kind of messy and, you know, they don't have it all figured out, but sooner or later they do. So I thought if I put my story out there, maybe there are morsels that will help you.
Absolutely. And honestly, I think it's probably one of the most important stories to be told, especially in this day and age, like especially when we're talking about some of the inequity that we see in STEM education, because honestly, like when you really start to look at the research as to why there have been historically so many fewer girls going into the sciences. And then now, even though we've got a lot of equity with in certain fields with starting college, there's still this horrible leaky pipeline. And at the highest levels, there are almost no women. And a lot of it really just comes down to stereotype threat. It really just comes down to the fact that we are raised to think we're not going to be good at it. And as girls, we're taught that if something is scary and overwhelming to us, that we're allowed to have emotions, we're allowed to show them, and we're allowed to say, I'm scared, I don't want to do this. And boys are taught that they're not allowed to do that, and they are taught to fake it till they make it. And you see a massive gender difference because of that.
I think we're also, for years until recently, I feel like we've been taught this perfection where we're all afraid to fail. Instead mm-hmm. of seeing it as this opportunity of relearning, we're scared to death that somebody's going to see us imperfect, you know? See us without our Instagram filter on.
And that's so fundamental to the scientific method, right? Like all good scientists learned throughout the way that failure is how you learn and failure is what makes you better. And kind of, I think a true test of human nature is whether or not you can admit it to yourself and to other people.
Absolutely. Failure is something we should teach in schools, like for real. Like you should fall flat on your face and figure out how not to do that next time.
Oh, for sure. And of course, we've all failed so many times, but we've also been in systems that have failed us, haven't we? I mean, this memoir is not just about all the cool stuff that you learned along the way and how you've grown, but it's also about a lot of the kind of real hard truths of television production, of some of the behind the scenes stuff that's not always 100% fair or equitable.
I mean, television isn't glamorous as it is, but it's hard being, especially in those times, it was very hard being a female coming up with it. Like message boards were a new thing when Mythbusters started, and our producer insisted that we read them. And this was the birth of the troll. So yeah. I remember going online and seeing horrible things written about me that were just so mean. And I remember there was one time I read some phrase and it wasn't even that bad of an insult, but like I had just piled on so much of the weird trolling that I just like I couldn't even walk into the studio because I was like, I just want to cry right now. Why are people being mean? I'm just trying so hard. And it took years of just kind of the analyzation of the world to go, oh, that's just a troll and nobody can hurt me anymore. Like once I realized that this is just some anonymous person and they don't realize I'm a real human being, it gave me this sort of thicker skin. But like I would get all sorts of criticism from everything from my looks to my education, things that wouldn't necessarily be communicated about my male coworkers who had the same level of education. We all had the same job. We're all real people. None of us came onto the show because we were actors or models. But for some reason, like if I ate one too many tacos that day, all of a sudden it's either a pregnancy rumor or look, she's gaining weight. I'm like, what? Come on, guys. Seriously. Like this is really ridiculous.
Oh, yeah. And they'll focus on the dumbest thing. Like, they're talking about hair color. They're talking about the cut of a shirt. They're talking like every little thing. There's commentary that you're right. It just is not reflected the same way towards, sometimes it is now, but not generally reflected the same way towards men when they're on camera. And the sad thing is that now that we're in the era of YouTube and Instagram, there are so many girls who are experiencing this for the first time, girls and women who are having to learn how to navigate kind of the troll boards, you know? And I don't know, the advice that I always give, and I wonder if you feel the same way about this, is that like, if you want to read the comments, that's fine. It can be helpful for your work to see what your fans and your followers are into. But at the same time, you better make sure you're not having a mental health day beforehand. Like, it's totally fine to avoid when you're not in the right headspace.
And also, my advice on any of this stuff is I love to engage with my audience. I love talking back with the people who, you know, tweet me or Instagram me. But I just don't engage with anybody that says anything mean because it's just not worth my time. So I just skip over those.
Oh, yeah. And like now there's so many great block functions and mute functions. And, you know, it's your space. It's your environment that you're curating. If it's your Instagram page, your Facebook page, even your Twitter, like you don't have to talk to people you don't want to talk to. And you can like legit block them so that you have a friendly feed. That's fine.
You know, I never even bother blocking anybody because anybody that I don't respond to that says something mean usually just goes away on their own.
That's so good. And also, it's funny that when you get to a certain level, which you, I mean, you are probably, I would say, the most famous, if not one of the most famous female kind of science, communicator science advocates out there. And at a certain point, you actually have fans and followers who kind of will reply on your behalf.
That is true. That is true.
It's kind of funny. You kind of like leave that to the, and then you just have to be like, oh, can you like mute me from this thread?
I
don't want to read these anymore.
I feel like my audience is very special because they tend to be like, at this point, they've all been sort of whittled down to people who tend to either like me or I find them incredibly intelligent. I feel like I have a smarter audience who doesn't really engage in some of the trollism anymore.
Oh, yeah, I'm definitely not surprised. I mean, the work that you did first on Mythbusters and then moving forward is so engaging and it's so inspiring that I think I do think that you're in a really special position where you aren't just preaching to the choir. You don't just reach the already super nerdy, super science-y minded people. You do have a broader net, which is, I think, the holy grail for a lot of science communicators. But that said, it does take a special interest to care about the kinds of things that you focus on and you talk about. And it's so great that that you've curated this wonderful base through that.
Well, you probably have some overlap here. So that's probably your audience too. I mean, talk nerdy, come on.
Oh, yeah. I can tell you right now without a doubt that the vast majority of the people listening to this podcast right now are like, oh, yeah, I already have the book. It's on my bookshelf, which is so great.
Sweet.
But the ones who don't, guys, you need to check it out. It's Crash Test Girl. I'll say it a few more times throughout the show. So I do have to ask, though, because we're talking about, you know, trolls on the internet, like kind of anti-fans, whatever you want to call them. But unfortunately, it's not just the kind of viewers that sometimes bring the hate. There's this passive problem that luckily now has kind of been brought a little bit more to the forefront in production itself.
Yeah.
We're talking equal pay. I mean, we just saw it happen to Claire Foy on The Crown. We're talking, you know, really non-equivalent treatment. Those of us who have worked in television have all experienced it. And you were really at the forefront.
I mean, there's definitely some sort of institutionalized gender bias where I've noticed specifically with companies that I've worked for where I will watch equally qualified producers, one woman, one man, and the man gets a much higher rate offered than the woman. And you know, we look out for it now, and I look out for my fellow female coworkers. So if I see it, I will, you know, take that to task. I find it horrifying that that's still happens. I've even seen a senior producer getting offered less than a junior producer who is a woman.
Wow. And,
I mean, my personal story is that I was being paid less than the guys for a while and had no idea until we started discussing it. You know, we were talking about like, you know, your seasons were changing, we were going to get a raise, and I found out they were making so much more than me. And I had been on the show the longest. We had the exact same job title. We had the equal educational backgrounds as far as like the level of degree that we had. Like, there was no reason at all that I should have been paid less. So when I brought it to the attention of, you know, the woman that does the negotiation, she tried to come up with all sorts of crazy excuses of why I should be paid less. And I'm like, no, like none of that makes sense. I am an equal in every way. I just want to be paid exactly the same. And then so finally, after many, many, many very angry conversations, she agreed to pay me the same and then gave the guys a raise. And I don't know if it was an accident or she was trying to spite me, but it hurt my soul. So I went out and got an agent. And
yeah, I was going to ask, did you have somebody negotiating on your behalf yet?
But even time, I mean,
it even happens with agents, though. You know, it's like that it helps, but that doesn't fully protect against this inequity that we all see.
Well, I went and found myself specifically an agent that has a very strong mother and he's a feminist himself. And he was all about helping me get these League of All Nations contracts. So now, you know, institutionally, when I go in for a job, I will put a clause in that says I must be paid the same as people who have the same job as me. And that's just from the get. Like it's actually in my contracts that you can't pay me less, you know, for having the same job title. That's impossible now. And I'm hoping that it'll become a standard and I won't have to add that in. But I counsel a lot of girls I know that are coming, you know, from YouTube into TV or that sort of thing. And I get called for advice all the time. Just like, you got to look out for it. You have to have the conversation. You have to figure out how not to be taken advantage of. And you can't be scared to talk about it. Cause that's the one thing that I've noticed with men negotiating is they kind of go in almost interviewing the interviewer. Like,
yes.
What do you do skills for me?
Yeah. And it's like they're raised to go in kind of knowing their worth, I think. And there's just so many cultural, societal, and other kind of influences on us as women that it's such a passive thing. You almost don't even realize it's happening. But, you know, amongst all of my friends who work in television and who are writers, we talk about this quite a lot. And it's just women, I think, by and large, I notice that there's a trend within at least my friend group. It's very hard for us to negotiate on our behalf. So we're always like, oh, yeah, no, that's fine. I don't want to be a burden. No, I understand. You know? And we end up suffering for it. And, you know, you're right. Like, my agent seeks out usually contracts that they have to have a favored nations clause, which is kind of the same thing. Like, everybody gets paid the same. When they say, oh, this is favored nations, that's why we can't negotiate for more, I'm relieved. I mean, I wish I could make more money on a show, but I'm like, oh, thank goodness. That means nobody makes more money on the show.
Yeah. I mean, and I think putting us all sort of on even ground is also, it's just empowering to know that you're standing together.
Mm-hmm. Completely. And, you know, that doesn't solve all the other problems about how we're treated differently, about, you know, the names and lights and, you know, how people are represented in programming and in advertising. I mean, there's so many things and there's so many cooks in the kitchen and you just see it systematically. And also, I think even larger than that is the problem that there just simply aren't that many female hosted science shows in the American landscape. There's like two.
I know. For years, I was the only woman at these Discovery, you know, we'd have these mm-hmm. parties and I'd look around, it was all sea captains and motorcycle builders and comics. And I'd just be like, where's all the ladies? I'm like, oh, they're all the way over there at TLC. What's up?
Oh, no.
For some reason, people have this idea in their head that like women just don't want to learn about science and they don't want to watch it on TV. So why would you have a female host unless she was hot?
Oh, yeah.
Like, I feel like that is what has kind of become. And I would really like to see it. I'd like to see networks start creating culture rather than trying to pretend they're reflecting it. I want to see them instead of a programming like, you know, their main station, you know, just to a specific, you know, men 25 to 50. I would love it if they programmed it a little more gender neutrally to see who actually fell in. So I feel like we're almost pigeonholing people. Like, you know, if you're going to watch something science, it's going to be on the science channel. If you're going to watch something historical, it's going to be on the history channel. Like, I miss being able to stumble upon things. I don't think Mythbusters would have been quite as big as it was if it wasn't on Discovery, because Discovery had all of these different kinds of genres. So mm-hmm. maybe you watch American Chopper and then watch Mythbusters because it happened to be on and you're like, oh, I like this too.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, and then it actually did bring forward a new audience. You know, it was the number one show on the network. It brought in people that never watched Discovery before, and then they could learn new things as well. But you're right. I mean, still to this day, this sort of fear and pigeonholing exists. And I don't want to throw any specific networks under the bus or name any specific names, but I have sat in a room with a network executive in programming and development who literally said the words, we're just not ready for female hosted programming. I have looked at decks that that networks have put forth that used euphemisms like muscular curiosity to describe the programming they were looking for. And I was like, oh my God, it's so sexist.
Have you ever noticed that every single show that's about roller coasters always puts the a very well-endowed woman in the front seat of the roller coaster. Like,
oh my
start
God.
Watching for it. Any roller coaster show on any network, that's every single time I'm like, oh, God. You know, I'm starting to notice this, which means it's a thing.
Jeez. And I really think that you started an incredible trend of having a strong woman out in front. And now I've had her on my show before, Emily Calandrelli. She's one of my co-correspondents on Bill Nye Saves the World. But she also does a Saturday morning television show called Exploration Out of Space. And it's female hosted, one of the only ones. Now, Jana Levin is hosting Nova, the first ever female host of Nova. Like, we are slowly but surely making these steps, but it's 2018, people.
By the way, I know Emily. I love Emily. She's
the best.
She recently did a TED talk about science communication and being nice and how to convince somebody of your views without, you know, without making them feel stupid. And it was the most incredible, inspiring TED talk. So I highly recommend everybody go check her out.
Absolutely. Yeah. She's just incredible. She's been on the show. She was the keynote speaker for SciComm Camp, which is a science communication retreat that I co-run every year. She was our keynote last year and did a great talk along a similar vein, talking about growing up in West Virginia in coal country and not wanting to make all of the coal miners feel like they're not allowed to be in the science club because they love coal. It's a tough thing, right? Because we're living in a culture that's very divided right now. We're more tribal than we've really ever been, at least in my lifetime. And what we need to be working toward is connecting, not dividing. And I mean, I just got to keep coming back to the incredible work that you do, because Carrie, you have this real skill of like inspiring and exciting, not just like the academic types, but also I think these very salt of the earth, blue collar, like America's Americans. And regardless of what your personal politics may be, I mean, I can only guess or assume because we're both lefty coasters, but I think that the places where I grew up in Texas, and I know that like, my Texas old friends and family members loved Mythbusters and love the work that you do. You really transcend, I think, some of those divisions, which is, gosh, what an incredible position to be in.
Well, thank you. I mean, I honestly think it is because I'm not an academic, and I don't think that there was any way I'd have any errors about what we were experimenting with, because I was figuring it out as I went along. And I mean, that's just what science is. It isn't something that has to be just for an elitist academic. It can be for everybody. I think that's one thing that we're missing right now, is that science is, it's life. It's the computers I'm talking on right now. It's the phone in my hand. It's the car I drive. It's all around me. And it's a hard thing to deny. I think it's, we have to create a more welcoming situation for, like you say, the salt of the earth types.
All right, guys, I want to take a quick moment to thank the sponsor of this week's episode, Blue Apron. And you know that their mission is to make incredible home cooking accessible to everyone. And they do that by offering three super easy to follow plans. There's a 2-person meal plan. It serves, as the name implies, 2 people. You can pick from 8 new recipes per week, and you have the choice to receive either 2 or 3 recipes on any given week. There's a family meal plan, which serves 4 people, where you can choose from 4 new recipes per week with the choice to receive either 2, 3, or 4 recipes a week. And there's also, a wine plan, where you get 6 bottles of wine from renowned winemakers delivered monthly. Now, guys, you get so much out of working with Blue Apron. You get convenience, you get variety, you get flexibility, and you get high quality. And what I love is how easy it is to cook at home when you use Blue Apron. You don't have to go to the grocery store. You don't have to buy a bunch of excessive ingredients that then you end up wasting, throwing away, that end up going bad. They send you exactly what you need. It's perfectly portioned, and they send you incredibly easy to follow recipe guides. That's my favorite part, because in the kitchen, I don't know what I'm doing, but the food always turns out great. There are awesome recipes coming up on the menu this month. How about some Sichuan-style pork noodles with snow peas and bird's eye chili? Yum. Or how about chicken and poblano tostadas with roasted zucchini? Yum, yum. And this very next week, what could you get? Roasted sweet potato quesadillas, Shanghai Kung Pao chicken, spring pea and mushroom ramen. Oh yeah, if you're a vegetarian, if you don't eat red meat, you're totally taken care of. There are plenty of options for you. And right now, you can check out this week's menu and you can get your first three meals for free at blueapron.com/nerdy. That's a really big deal. Three meals free at blueapron.com/nerdy. All right, guys, let's get back to the show. I mean, I have to ask you what it was like for you when you were, you know, first starting out, you're working in this shop, you're building things, you're trying to push the limits and make things work. And eventually you guys stumble into this really cool format, which is like, let's apply these principles of the scientific method to all of these kind of myths. Let's bust them. How was it for you to first learn about the scientific method in a really experimental way, which, you know, a lot of people first learn about it out of books, which is a bummer. It's so much better to learn about it in the lab or in real life. What was it like for you to learn it and finesse it and really start to, I don't know, appreciate it in a hands-on kind of way?
I mean, I think it was years before we figured out we were actually using it. It just happens to be the perfect vehicle for a narrative for busting myths. So, I mean, we were structuring the show like that, not necessarily intentionally, but logically, it just fell into that distinction. So when the show became, you know, a little more plug and play, because we figured out what we were doing and we did get to use the scientific method, it was sort of, it was jaw dropping to go, oh, this is way easier than I thought. We have this amazing outline that we can just plug the myths into, and it helps us figure everything out. And I'm like, I think I've been using this my whole life for everything. That's why I structured my book that way, because it just feels like a logical way to tell a story and to figure things out.
Oh, and it's just so important, I think, for people who either have some kind of fears around science and haven't really dug deep because they're, you know, it causes a lot of kind of internal angst and anxiety, or just for people who weren't, I don't know, I say lucky enough to have good science teachers in school or to have taken the kinds of classes where they might learn about some of these things. Like, it's so important to sort of represent the fact that science is not stuff in books. Science is not, you know, just ideas. Science is a method. It's a process. And you can apply it to so many things, can't you?
I mean, I think it's being taught more like that now. I feel like the world has definitely gotten a little more hands-on. I see a lot of teachers are getting a lot more passionate about the way they teach it. I mean, you still got to do some book learning.
Oh, yeah.
But it seems like there's a lot more experimentation happening as well.
And that's so good to hear. You know, I'm not the springiest of the chickens. So when I was in school, it was a bit more dusty, but you said that you have a daughter. Do you mind if I ask how old she is?
She is 8. So if you watched me pregnant on the show, that will make you feel old. She is
that
8 years old.
Such the perfect age. And also the age that all of the researchers are really trying to understand, like, this is where things start to change for a lot of young girls with regards to their path in life, with their interests. You know, it's where a lot of people are focusing their attention on how do we keep girls at this age interested and excited about pursuing careers that could be lucrative and about staying in the kind of training atmosphere that they need. So, oh my gosh, such a critical age. But it's so great that now you have these insights into how she's learning about these things.
Well, it's really interesting to watch her because she, you know, she's really interested in coding and computer science. But, you know, I have always put her in the after school programs or the classes that do it. And as every year, there's just less and less girls. And now there's only one other girl in her coding class. And I'm looking at this going, why? Why is it with all the boys? And the one day that the girl isn't there, she's super bummed because they'll be playing Minecraft. And she's like, I'm building pretty houses. And, you know, she comes up with all these storylines for it. And the boys come in and blow it up.
Oh, no.
Which... She can hold her own with blowing stuff up. She is my daughter, but she's always a little sort of disappointed that her narrative gets blown up. And it's funny. This is actually what is leading me into my next big project is I just became the chief creative officer for a startup toy company called Smart Girls.
It is
coding robot doll for girls. And we have, our brains are just different than boys and we play differently. So when you look at the market, there's a ton of boy toys that do coding and have robots and there's just nothing for girls. You know, Goldilocks started doing engineering toys and they were killing it with that. So I saw this company and I reached out to him maybe like a week ago and was like, I love what you're doing. You know, you're teaching block coding on your phone, which, you know, every kid is craving to use a screen, and you're programming a doll that's on sort of a Segway scooter to run through paths and obstacles all along the floor. But then it's also a doll. So they have this follow through storytelling. So I basically did the same thing I did for Mythbusters, where I just kind of showed up until they gave me a job. And, this is actually new. It's like, as of this week, I am working with them because STEAM and girls is still my rebel yell. And I am trying to figure out a way to have an impact, not just through television. So I'm trying to work with this company to help them develop all sorts of toys, things like, you know, we've got some other products in mind, but just all sorts of ways for girls to play, but do it through coding applications and computer science.
Oh, it's so needed, because you're right. Like, you mentioned Goldie Blocks, which is super cool. There's also Little Bits, and there's a small company out here in LA called Seedling, which is like Soleil Moon Fry's company. She's a co-founder, and they're these interactive toys, but they're very bespoke. No, bespoke's not really the right word, but it's just like, they're not sold in Walmart. You know what I mean? It's not like, they're not far reaching enough yet. And it's so great to see that this is a concerted effort that's starting to pop up in multiple places. Cause there's just, you're right, there's not enough. You go to the kind of older kid, toy section, and you see like the dolls for the girls, and then you see the microscopes, and they're like legit for boys. There's not cool. And you know what they used to do is they would be like, oh, we'll just paint it pink, and now it's a girl's microscope, and you're like, oh my god,
like, no!
It is so not the right approach. And so it's so great. I'm so excited to hear that you're working with this company. What are they called one more time?
Smart Girls. It's, and the girls is spelled GURLZ.
Hell yeah. Girls.
Girls.
And I just love to hear that they're really using these important principles of psychology and these, you know, developmental understandings to apply them to how, you know, they can make things that are going to impact these girls' lives for a long time, because there's no reason that play shouldn't also have a really positive influence and impact. And there's
that's how I learned science, is by playing.
Exactly.
It was all about play for me. And I'm like, wait, this is science? What? Why didn't I know this before? I'm old now. I should have been doing this the whole freaking time. And so now, you know, I'm in my kitchen making slime with my daughter, trying to figure out why things work.
Hell yeah.
Reliving my childhood through her.
That makes me so happy. And that's really the dirty little secret, is that that's all scientists do all day is play in the lab.
Right? It's just fun.
It so is. Ooh, I want to make slime. I'm 34. Is it okay if I make slime? I don't have kids.
Girl, I'm 43.
Hell yeah.
I've got a slime kit right here.
I love it. You know what I've gotten really into making lately? So dorky, is bath bombs. Bath bombs. Really? Oh, that makes me so happy, because they're so expensive in the store. And it's like fun chemistry to make them in your kitchen.
Well, you know, my family has a tradition every year that you have to make your gifts for Christmas. So one of my funnest to make for my daughter is, when she was really into, you know, bath time or whatever, I got a whole bunch of test tubes from one of my friends who worked at a lab, and I got all these weird little tiny bottles, and I made, all of these different scented sort of bath salts and colors and liquids that she could experiment with in the bathtub, so she could pretend that she was a chemist or, you know, a witch or a magician or whatever. And it was so much fun making little bath bombs or things that would like fuzz up when they dropped into the water. And so I just made this giant kit and labeled everything like unicorn tears or, you know, whatever it would be, so that she could experiment. She got so excited when anything would bubble or fizz or smell funny.
Oh my gosh, I love that so much. And I can tell you right now that there are at least 40 to 140, maybe even more, people listening to this podcast right now who are like writing out their shopping list. And it's so funny too, because this podcast, one of the things that, you know, I really struggle with, and I think it speaks to what we were talking about before, is that because I do a science show, for whatever reason, the vast majority of my listenership is men. And no offense, guys, I want you to be here, but like, I want more women to listen to the show. And I don't know what else I can do. I make sure that there's gender parity on the show. I make sure that like, I talk about things that are really important and necessary, for both men and women. But a really cool thing that I get in terms of feedback is so many young dads talking about doing cool science stuff with their daughters. And I just feel like what you just said has inspired birthday gifts galore. I'm so excited. Please, guys, send in your messages because I would love to hear about what you did for bath time sciencey fun.
Man, so, I feel like we have a whole new generation of really smart dads who are raising their girls to be your future listeners, quite honestly. That's one of the things when I would go around with all the STEM advocacy is I would meet really accomplished women in their fields and be like, all right, so what's your secret? And often it was a strong father figure that was passionate about science.
Yeah.
So that's, you know, I don't think it's just about women. It really is about all of us.
Oh, for sure. It's about allies. It's about working together. It's about inclusivity. It's about intersectionality. And I just think it's so, so necessary and important that there are people who look and act and talk and sound like us in positions of representation. Like, I mean, I can't say this enough, and I'm sure that you know this in your heart of hearts, and you've read the letters that you get and the feedback that you get, but like, there are girls out there, and probably now women out there, who are making a difference in the world because they saw you on television.
I mean, that makes me blush, and it was a really lovely side effect of Mythbusters that kind of thing happened. And, you know, whenever I meet someone, you know, at a Comic-Con or something that comes up and tells me that, like, it makes me want to cry because, as you know, I was an art major and I got into this kind of, you know, I've been jumping off cliffs trying to get into this career, and all of a sudden to have any sort of effect on anybody else's life is incredibly humbling. And I feel very grateful to have been given and have the opportunities that I've had. And I hope that I can create those I hope I can pay it forward. And I try to as much as I can, because I know that I'm lucky. So I spend a lot of time advocating for other science communicators whenever I can.
So, you know what? Let's talk a little bit about some of the difficulties along the way. You know, you mentioned in your book about the things that you learned. You talk a lot about, you know, the wonderful things that you've experienced and the ways that you have been really lucky, but this hasn't all been roses. We did talk a little bit about some of the struggles being a woman in television, especially at this turning point time. But, you know, even the road once you were on Mythbusters was a bit rocky. Before Mythbusters, you've had some rocky times. I mean, just looking through your book, like, I've learned that, you know, at some point you were living in your car. I learned how difficult it was to hear that news that you had been, you know, fired, and like, what comes next? And everybody goes through that. You know, we've all kind of brushed up against those things that can really strengthen us or put us in a position where we're not sure if we'll be able to move forward. So I'd love to learn a little bit from you about what those experiences were like from you.
I mean, we all get our roadblocks. And for me, I try very, very hard not to dwell on them, but create the next experiment.
Yeah.
My life's journey has been to try to create opportunities for myself. So whenever I'm in a place where I just feel like I need to be somewhere else, I reach out. Like, I call people to talk to them about what they do and why they did it. And it ends up always putting me in another place that's useful. Like, for instance, this toy company, I basically called them and said, can I have coffee with you? I'm interested in toys. I want to talk to you about it. And just kind of had that conversation until an opportunity came about to get the job on Mythbusters. I just showed up and interned until an opportunity came about. I think that it's when you're in places in your life where you're not happy, you have to change them and you have to be extremely proactive. So that's what I did in all facets of my life.
And you know what? When doors sometimes close, or even when other doors open and you're too inflexible, when you're not willing to say, maybe this is a weird opportunity. Yeah, it wasn't my plan. Yeah, I've never even thought about doing this in my life. But if you're too scared, which we all are. I mean, we're crippled by it. But if we don't take that leap, like you were talking about, and take a step through that door and just see what's on the other side of it, we may not. I mean, that's how we build resiliency, right? I mean, you are in a position now that you never would have been in if you hadn't just kind of held your breath and maybe shut your eyes real tight and said, okay, I'm going to jump off this cliff.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I put this in my book, The Harder I Work, The Luckier I Get. I truly believe that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And there are times when, you know, you feel like you're doing everything right, but things just still don't come. And that's, I think, a hard thing that almost everybody experiences in their life, where they're really busting their ass and they're really working hard and they're just not breaking through, or they're not getting where they need to be. And sometimes we get trapped in those feelings and it's hard for us to use our sense of perspective. But in the grand scheme of things, when we're able to look back and use hindsight, we really do see that ultimately those were the forks in the road, right? Like that's where we ended up kind of making the big decisions that really did affect our lives for the better.
Well, hey, when Mythbusters ended, I was in a panic. I was depressed. I could not figure out what was going to be next, because for me, that was my first grown-up job. So when it ended, there was definitely a period of time that was just panic. And I wrote this in the book, because I just still find it amusing. I went straight down to Theory and bought a pair of slacks, because I'm like, I guess I got to get a real job now. All right. Where's my LinkedIn profile? Like, I was just red. I'm like, okay, secretarial pool, here I come. You know, like that was just in my head for a minute there while I was panicking. And I was like, what do I really want to do? Okay, I have to tackle this like I've tackled everything. I have to create some new opportunities for myself. Okay, I loved being on television. So how about I start pitching my own shows? How about I start reaching out to networks and seeing what I can develop with them? And, you know, right after, you know, Mythbusters ended, you know, I made enough connections that I had development deals, and all of a sudden offers started coming through, because not because I was sitting around waiting for the phone to ring, but because I was picking the phone up and just calling people to see how I could create my next situation. Those Theory pants are still in my closet. I'm sure they look great, but I've never put them on. The still on them. And for some reason, it's become this like battle of will that like the day I cut that tag is the day I've lost.
Oh, so no.
I might have to blow the pants up. I might just have to take them to the range and blow them up so I don't have that fallback opportunity.
I love that that's also like a legitimate option in your life. You're like, I'll just take it to the range and blow it up.
You know what? When I was promoting this book and they're like, could you do like a little question and answer that we can maybe promote the book? It'll be an advertisement. I'm like, that is not how I do stuff. I'm like, let me give you a call back. And I call the sheriff's office. I'm like, hey, do I still got, you know, privileges? You think you could help me out? And I called my old Mythbusters crew. I'm like, yeah, what are you guys doing on Thursday? Would you like to maybe, I'll buy you some shots if you'll go to the range with me for the day? So we made this like explosion video instead of, you know, a regular talky head kind of thing for the promotion of the book. And it was so much more fun.
Oh, I love that. That is so funny. I love that you, even to this day, will always maintain your bit of pyromania. It's such a fun thing to have in your life. And like, what a cool way to just feel like so empowered and like such a badass, right?
Well, you know, I do black powder paintings as my hobby. So I explode black powder onto pages and try to fence them off in ways so that it actually makes some piece of either abstract art, or I make negative space and make pictures within the black powder. So I think that's just ingrained in me.
Sounds like it.
You know, when the Mythbusters: The Search was filming, one of the producers, they needed black powder or some explosives immediately. And I don't know if you know Kyle Hill from Nerdist.
Oh, he's a good friend of mine. He was one of my, like in my first 10 episodes of the show.
That's awesome. So he was hosting that show at the time, and we were joking on his podcast or his live feed earlier, because, you know, they needed explosives, and they're like, one of the producers like, hold on a minute. And they called me. I'm like, oh, sure, I'll send some over to you. So I just made this little box of explosives that I sourced quite easily. And I just happened to also be baking cupcakes that day. So I put in some candy and some cupcakes, and I sent them this beautiful little gift pack, and they were all just dying when they opened it. They're like, who has both explosives and pink frosting, like easily sourced.
my heart is like so warm hearing that story. It makes me so freaking happy. And your daughter, she just must be so incredibly proud of her mama. And I know you're probably just so proud of her. Gosh, I can't tell you how excited this interview is making me. I'm just all smiles today. Well, Carrie, I don't want to keep you too much longer, but I would be really remiss if I ended this episode without asking you the same two questions that I ask everybody who comes on the show. I'm so fascinated to hear what your answers are, but these are very big picture questions. So, you ready to dive into them?
I don't know. Maybe.
We'll see, right? Okay. So I want you to think about the future. Something that I'm sure that you do as both a mom and as a freelancer and, you know, just somebody who's always having to kind of be one step ahead. I want you to think about the future, and you can think about whatever context is relevant to you right now. Maybe you've been preoccupied with more global issues. Maybe you've been thinking about the future of your family. You know, whatever is relevant. The first thing is, what is the thing that recently has really been keeping you up at night? What's kind of worrying you? What are you actually legitimately concerned about? And, you know, hoping that we can affect change just to try and fix some of these wrongs. And on the flip side, so that we end on something of a positive note, I would love to know what you are genuinely hopeful for. What is it that you have true optimism about? You know, where are things looking shiny and bright?
Well, there's two things that keep me up at night. One, I'm really worried about climate denial, the climate change denial, because I live next to the ocean, and the idea that it's getting warmer and killing off the algae that the fish eat, and I just see that chain reaction happening, terrifies me. But on a more local level, it's weird watching my daughter interact with social media, and I feel like we've gotten to this strange place where I watch a lot of younger people almost creating their own hell with their Instagram feeds, because they're creating experiences so that they can put them on Instagram rather than experiencing these pieces of their life. It's like they're crafting it for other people. And I feel like that's going to create a sadness and a depression. So I really want to pull my daughter enough away from the screen so that she leaves the phone at home and we go to the beach and you just experience the beach, and nobody else needs to see that, because it's inside of you. Because I've had all of these incredible experiences. I spent a year backpacking around the world and meeting people and seeing things. And I feel like if I documented it on Instagram, I wouldn't have had the learning experience I had from it. Like I wouldn't, you know, I don't want to have to put on makeup to go rafting. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And also it wouldn't have been yours really, you know, like it wouldn't have been so personal. It seems like you're right. There's this facade that kids are creating their reality, not for themselves, but to prove to other people that they're cool or that they're interesting or that they're pretty. And it's so sad to have that kind of pressure on you every day.
And then you look at everybody else's and you're, you know, like I'll see people, you know, my friends have these feeds and I'm like, wow, it looks like you and your family have the perfect life and the perfect job and you make the perfect cupcake. And then I'll talk to a person and be like, oh my God, I think that life is awful. We might get divorced. The kids are giving me hell. I'm just like, wow, what a weird pressure to have to constantly present yourself. It was so clean and fresh.
Oh my gosh. You know, it's like, I'm one of those people who has a really hard time thinking to take photos. I think it's a blessing. It also has been a bit of a curse in my career because it's like, yeah, sorry, I don't document my life the way that a lot of people do, but I have friends who do that. And you're right. You look at their Instagram feeds and you're like, you're so beautiful. You're so perfect. You're getting all these branding opportunities, blah, blah, blah. But then you realize they didn't take that with their iPhone. That was with a $5,000 DSLR. They had somebody following them around taking those pictures. They spent all day primping and preening and like doing, it's a facade. It really is. Like, this isn't just casual, oh, I just snapped that photo and it turned out that way. It's like, no, you spent an hour in front of your editing software to make it look the way you wanted it to make. It's bananas.
And then it creates those standards that get higher and higher and higher. And all of a sudden we've got regular people that are trying to make their lives look like an Instagram style, you know?
Yeah, it's just recapitulating the cover of all of the Vogue magazine, you know, the same problems we had when we were growing up, when we would see these 14-year-old models who were perfect on the cover of magazines, not realizing at the time how retouched they were, how they were, you know, that their cellulite was erased and airbrushed out, and that the acne on their face was like magically deleted. And now that we know that, we kind of know that it's a thin veil of reality. But you're right, there's so many people, they just, it's hard for them to make that realization, which is a bummer. Oh gosh, so I'm getting depressed.
Positive, like positive for the future. I mean, honestly, clearly this is my field right here, but I am very positive about women and the empowerment that's happening. I feel like that there is just a new movement of, I think it's the world is sort of catching up, and I feel like girls are going to have a better future because of what women are doing right now. And I'm feeling very hopeful for my daughter and the opportunities that she's going to have.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we really, I think, are standing on the shoulders of giants. And I think that there continue to this day to be people who are really at the bleeding edge, because unfortunately, the battle is not yet won. And there have to be people who are making these really important strides for equity. And it's, I have to just thank you one more time for being at the forefront of that movement, for being such an inspiration and such a role model, not just for your daughter, but for daughters, you know, across the globe. And I have to thank you also for taking time out of your super busy schedule to reach out and chat with us today. It was just such an honor.
I follow you guys on social media, so I know what you're up to anyway. I'm a fan right back at you, girl.
Oh, you're so sweet. Guys, the book is Crash Test Girl, An Unlikely Experiment in Using the Scientific Method to Answer Life's Toughest Questions by, of course, Carrie Byron. And thank you so much for being here, Carrie.
Thank you.
And everybody listening, thank you for coming back week after week. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.